Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute for our discussion on Australia's top 12 treasurers. We're very grateful to Lendlease for the use of, for the first time, for this fine facility with the wonderful Sydney Rock behind us. Now, we've got Chris Bowen makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, and Selwyn Cornish makes a welcome first visit. Chris Bowen is very well known to all of you, but I'll introduce him briefly. He was elected to the Federal Parliament as a member for Prospect in 2004. That seat subsequently was renamed McMahon in 2010. Mr. Bowen was appointed to the Federal Labor Party's front bench as the Shadow Assistant Treasurer and Shadow Minister for Revenue and Competition Policy in 2006, and he was appointed Treasurer by Prime Minister Kevin Rudd in 2013. And of course, he's the current Shadow Treasurer in Bill Shorten's led opposition. Selwyn Cornish is the official historian for the Reserve Bank and currently working on a history of the Reserve Bank. He's Adjunct Associate Professor at the Research School of Economics at the ANU in Canberra. He's the author of a number of books, a co-author of the book Gilbin's Platoon on the influential figures in the Australian public service working as economist, economist in Australian public life. He's the co-author of Aunt's Story, the biography of the economist Heinz Arndt. He's done a book on central banking in Australia, and as I said, he's working on the history of the Reserve Bank. So we'll start off with Chris Bowen. He's going to make some comments, then Selwyn Cornish will make some comments, and then they'll talk to one another, and then we'll go to questions and discussion. Mr. Bowen, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Gerard, and thanks Sydney Institute for hosting us tonight. It's wonderful, and this is the first event we've done on the book, and it's very kind of you to have offered to host tonight. I thought to get us going tonight, I might just share a few thoughts and answer a few questions people have asked me along the way about the Money Men. And primarily amongst them is, why have you written this book? And it had always, frankly, been a book I wanted to write. I always thought there was a gap in our history. If you walk through a bookstore or a library, you'll find scores of books on Australian Prime Ministers, but you'll find none on Australian Treasurers, which is a gap, I think, which needed to be filled. And when I transitioned from being Treasurer to Shadow Treasurer, I thought, well, maybe this is my opportunity to fill the gap and to write the book. And I thought, having been Treasurer and aspiring to be Treasurer again, I might have some value to add in assessing the history of our Treasurers. And I thought about writing about all of them, but I thought that would be too long, given there's been 39. I thought about just writing about the best ones, or the Labor ones, but in the end, I decided to write about the most notable ones. And as I said, I thought about the way this has been done elsewhere. There have been three books on Chancellors of the Exchequer, two of them by serving politicians, one by a former Chancellor, Roy Jenkins, another by a former Treasury Minister and often touted as a potential Chancellor, Edmund Dell, and then the third book as well. And I thought about calling the book A Treasurer on Treasurers, in the tradition of Harold Wilson's book, A Prime Minister on Prime Ministers, but I thought that might be a touch arrogant given I was only Treasurer for 4 months. So we settled on The Money Men. Now, this is a book of the people I think are Australia's most notable Treasurers, and that was a hard task to determine which 12. There were some who I just couldn't choose because MEP was getting concerned about the word count and the book was getting too thick. So I had to draw the line somewhere, and some Treasurers who could have been justified, like John Bilkins or Richard Casey, unfortunately I just couldn't fit in, but perhaps somebody else might fill that gap at some point in the future. I picked the 12 because I thought there was some lesson in their tenure in the Treasury portfolio. It's not necessarily the 12 best, certainly not the 12 worst, but the 12 most interesting. And each of them, I thought, had just something to teach us. And certainly as I researched their tenures, I learnt more and I could find more lessons. Some of them were treasurers for a long time. Some of them were treasurers only very briefly, Bill Hayden and Jim Cairns, 6 months each, but in such a tumultuous time that I thought they justified their inclusion. Some were treasurers during a period of particular challenge, World War II, the end of World War I, or the Great Depression, or the global financial crisis. And some were treasurers who were enormous successes, and some were failures. Not many were failures, but some had very great difficulties. And I knew when I wrote it that most of the attention in the aftermath of printing the book, publishing the book, would fall on what I wrote about the most recent treasurers, about Costello and Swan and, to a lesser degree, Keating and Howard. I knew that, and that has been the case. But I have to tell you, while I enjoyed writing about each of our recent treasurers, and I'd like to think there's some interesting history there and some interesting perspectives, others will judge, some will think, some have already told me I'm too harsh on Costello and too soft on Swan. Others tell me I'm far too soft on Costello, and that's just the nature of publishing a book with views in it. And I try and be objective and fair in the book. So as a partisan political operative, that is not always the way, but I do try and be objective and fair even though I reach my own conclusions. I am critical of some elements of Labor history, even though I'm very proud of Labor's achievements. But what I really did enjoy was writing about some of those treasurers who have been forgotten by history, and I like to think that's where perhaps we've added the most in this book, because broadly speaking, most people interested in economics and politics do understand the Keating period, the Costello period. They may have different perspectives, but some of our treasurers have been lost to history. I'll just take a few moments to speak about some of the things I learnt in that exercise. Every so often there's an opinion poll where young people and all of us are asked to name Australia's first Prime Minister, and you know, many fail the test and can't name Edmund Barton. I query how a poll would go if we're all asked to name Australia's first Treasurer. I think the results would be pretty disappointing. But Sir George Turner was a fascinating character. He actually played such an important role in Federation. He was a taciturn, uncharismatic former mayor of St Kilda who happened to become Treasurer and Premier of Victoria at the time of Federation. And he plays an unsung role in our history because, as you know, our first Governor-General committed a monumental blunder in his choice of Prime Minister. And this caused a constitutional crisis before Federation had even occurred. And it was George Turner who fixed it as the Premier of the second largest colony. And he went to see the Governor-General and the Prime Minister-designate and said, "I will not serve." And the failure of the Premier of Victoria to serve in the first cabinet was lethal and fatal to the putative Prime Minister, and he fixed Australia's first constitutional crisis. And as Premier of Victoria, it was automatic that he would be chosen to serve in the first cabinet. Every Premier was invited to serve in the cabinet. And as Treasurer of Victoria, he was chosen as Treasurer. And he is a seminal figure in the history of the Treasury portfolio. He established the Treasury. And it had seven employees to start with and was a body of purely accountants. And it was the role of the Treasury to keep tab on the transfer of funds between the state and the Commonwealth. That was the entire role of the Treasury. And, of course, it evolved over the years under successive treasurers who professionalised it under Spender and Fadden and Chifley. The Treasury brought in economists and was professionalised. And then there's William Watt. Now, William Watt is another person who's been lost to history. I have to confess I didn't know of him before I started writing this book, and I was researching a page and I came across these references to Watt, and I went down a burrow and started exploring the treasurership of William Watt, and I found it an absolutely fascinating story. And I won't spoil it for you, but of all the chapters I wrote, I'd have to confess, Watt was probably my favourite, because He was, again, a former Treasurer and Premier of Victoria. He was a serious, taciturn, good administrator, solid performer, and he worked as Treasurer for Billy Hughes, who was a hothead and difficult to work for. You can tell that because he was Prime Minister for 7 years and had six treasurers. And I found the cables between Watt and Hughes because a month after becoming Treasurer, Hughes left Australia and went to London and Versailles to represent Australia at the peace talks for World War I. And under the circumstances in place in that time, there was no formal role of Deputy Prime Minister. The Treasurer automatically became Acting Prime Minister in the Prime Minister's absence. And Watt, after having been Treasurer for a month, became Acting Prime Minister for 17 months. And he was Prime Minister, in effect, for longer than many people who have their photo on the wall who've served in the office officially. And it was quite clear, in looking at the history, that Hughes and Watt had no discussion about how things were going to work while Hughes was away. And Watt, as the competent administrator that he was, thought that the Cabinet should operate, and he called the Cabinet together, which came as a relief to Cabinet members who weren't used to being consulted by the Prime Minister. And he started making decisions, and Cabinet government started functioning, much to Hughes's anger and disgust. And Hughes started sending cables back to Watt in Melbourne, of course, which was the capital, and expressing his dismay that the Cabinet was functioning. And I reproduce some of those cables, and I've got to tell you, 100 years later, I think they bristle down the page at you. The anger between the two men, between the Prime Minister and the Treasurer, as they express their frustration with each other, that each is trying to run the government. Hughes from Versailles and Watt from Melbourne. And you'll be your own judge as to who was in the right and who was in the wrong. But I think it's a fascinating story of how a relationship breaks down between a Prime Minister and a Treasurer. And, of course, then Watt goes off to London on Hughes' return to negotiate the wool contract because the British government had not paid for the wool for the uniforms that Australia had sold them during World War I. And Hughes proceeds, having instructed Watt as to what to do as Prime Minister, then continues to send him cables in London to instruct him as to how to conduct the negotiations. And I'll just share one of the cables with you. When Watt arrives in London, he opens the Times and finds that Hughes has announced from Melbourne the negotiating strategy of the Australian government. And he sends his Prime Minister a cable. "Astonished that you should have expounded a scheme to outsiders, portion of which vitally affects my mission, without prior consultation with me. Times today publishes telegram from Sydney outlining whole scheme, which has caused consternation in wool circles. This publicity is a gravely embarrassing fact. You must see that it is impossible to run a business on these lines." And they go on and on. Eventually, without spoiling it for you, it ends in tears with the most spectacular resignation of any treasurer in history, when Watt has had enough. So that is what I felt added the most value. As I said, there are debates about the contemporary treasurers and people have their views about those, and all the living treasurers who I write about were very generous with their time. Bill Hayden, John Howard, Peter Costello, Wayne Swan and Paul Keating, all generous with their time with me and to share their perspectives, and they will agree with some of the conclusions and not the others. Just before I sit down, some people have questioned why Jim Cairns has been included. As I said, this is not a book of the 12 best treasurers in history. It is a book of who I think are the 12 most interesting. And of the three iconic scandals of the Whitlam government, Cairns was in the middle of two of them. And I think the most interesting thing out of Cairns is, I'm not kind to his legacy, I don't think he was a good treasurer at all, but he was, on paper, our most prepared. 3 degrees, a bachelor, a master's in commerce and a doctor of philosophy in economic history. Our most academically qualified treasurer in our history. You would think he started with a pretty good pedigree. But I conclude that he was a fiercely intelligent man, lacking judgment. And again, a compelling story, I think, which underlines why he failed was that he was at the lodge for a meeting of the National Executive of the Labor Party one night, And he wandered off into the Prime Minister's dining room, and room I've spent many a night having dinner with, so I understand the geography of the lodge. And he wandered in, opened the door, and there was the Prime Minister and the Minister for Resources and the Attorney General having an executive council meeting. And the Treasurer said, "What's happening here then?" And the Prime Minister said, "Well, we're borrowing a lot of money, and we're going to get it from a Pakistani." And the Treasurer of Australia said, "Oh, okay then," and wandered off. I can't think of any other Treasurer who would have put up with that. So they're just some opening remarks from me, and we're going to have a good conversation tonight. It's a great pleasure for me to share the podium with Selwyn Cornish. Selwyn is, in my view, the preeminent active economic historian in Australia. He probably shares the title of the preeminent living economic historian with Boris Sheverden, but he is the preeminent active economic historian, the official historian of the Reserve Bank, and so much more. And as I say in the acknowledgements, Selwyn was kind enough to read the drafts and provide me with feedback. And, you know, from time to time would tell me my interpretation of Page's, you know, speech in 1927 was slightly off mark, and I might want to tweak a little bit here and there, which was invaluable as I searched through the archives and tried to interpret facts and figures from a long ago period. So I very much appreciate the fact that Selwyn's here tonight, and pay my respects to his very fine achievements as the economic historian of note of Australia. Thanks for your time tonight.
Just before Selwyn Cornish comes up, I should have said at the start that we're here on the occasion of the launch of The Money Men, Australia's 12 Most Notable Treasurers, written by Chris Bowen, published by MUP. And now Selwyn Cornish is going to make some comments on Chris Bowen's book.
Well, thanks very much. Chris, thanks very much for those over-generous comments in your introduction. I must say that I'm very pleased that at last we have a book on Australian treasurers. As Chris has pointed out, there have been several books written on British chances of the Exchequer, but until now we haven't had one on Australian treasurers. It's been a bit of a mystery to me why we have waited so long for such a book. We also don't have a history of the Australian Treasury, and again, there have been several books written about the British Treasury. But anyway, we now have a terrific book on Australian treasurers, and congratulations, Chris, on the tremendous amount of work you've put into this book. And I agree that although most of us know quite a bit about Paul Keating and Peter Costello and John Howard and so on, it's fascinating to read about George Turner and William Watt and Earl Page, and as we come closer to the present time, we know more about the people. We don't have to spend a great deal of time thinking about these earlier people, but the whole book is a terrific book. Chris and I haven't rehearsed how we're going to do this question and answer session, but I thought that I would make a few comments, and then Chris could respond to those, and then I'll make a few more, and then he could respond to those, depending on how much time we have. The first thing that struck me reading Chris's book is that in his introduction he says, quote, "He learnt things writing this book that will make me a better treasurer should I receive the honour of serving in the post again." And he quotes the British statesman and novelist Benjamin Disraeli, who himself was a Chancellor of the Exchequer and later Prime Minister of the UK. Chris quotes Disraeli as saying, quote, "The best way to become acquainted with the subject is to write a book about it." What strikes me about some of these more prominent of our treasurers covered in Chris's book is their capacity to learn and their propensity to relearn. In fact, they were lifelong learners. For example, Theodore. He left school at 12. He was a voracious reader. He read books all his life. He was the first person in Australia to have a copy of Keynes's Treatise on Money, a big two-volume book, which was sent out to him by the Anglo-Australian financier W.S. Robinson. And quite often, quite frequently, Theodore was to be seen sitting on the front bench in the House of Representatives reading the Treatise on Money and other books on economics. Chifley left school around the age of 15. Like Theodore, he continued to read widely and enrolled in several courses at technical colleges through the early part of his life. Like Theodore, Chifley lost his seat at the 1931 election and didn't come back into Parliament until 1940. But in 1936-37, Chifley was a member of the famous Royal Commission on the Australian Monetary and Banking Systems. He spent 2 years with other members of the Royal Commission interviewing all the top economists in Australia, all the top bankers, heads of insurance companies and so on. And it was a great experience for him. He learnt a lot in those 2 years, which became very useful when he later became Treasurer, as he was between 1941 and 1949. You look at Fadden and Bill Hayden. Both of them left school at a very early age. Fadden later acquired accountancy qualifications, working on the Rhodes Board in Mackay, and he became a very good accountant. Hayden left school also very early, became a policeman, unexpectedly won the seat of Oxley in 1961 in the big swing in Queensland after the credit squeeze of late 1960. And he came into Parliament and he decided that he was going to undertake an economics degree externally from the University of Queensland. And quite often at night he'd be seen reading and writing in the Parliamentary Library, writing essays for his degree. Keating, as we know, left school at 15, studied later at night for his HSC, and he cultivated experts in various fields, from economics and business to antique clocks and paintings. He was always interested in learning new things. And I think this was very... very interesting that although many of them left school very early, they continued to learn. Another thing, and perhaps Chris might like to comment on that in a moment, but another thing that struck me reading the various chapters in Chris's books is that many of these treasurers were prepared to sacrifice their positions, even sacrifice their seats, to implement decisions which they thought were in the best interests of the country. Take Theodore, for example. Theodore supported the Premier's plan. Keynes said in a famous article in the Melbourne Herald in 1932, and I quote, "The Premier's plan saved Australia." Now, Theodore, the Premier's plan was not Theodore's favourite plan in the so-called battle of the plans that went on in 1930 and 31. He wanted a much more expansionary program. But the Commonwealth Bank wouldn't fund it, and the Labor Party, the Scullin government, didn't have control of the Senate. And so he supported the Premier's plan. Without his support, it's doubtful that the Labor Party would have supported what Keynes said saved Australia. A few months later, 1931 election, Lang, who didn't like Theodore and certainly didn't like him supporting a deflationary policy, although Lang himself was forced to lend his weight behind it to some degree. 1931 election at the end of the year, Theodore lost his seat to a Lang Labor candidate and never came back into politics. Chifley threw his weight behind the Bretton Woods agreements. The left wing of the Labor Party and several of his own cabinet ministers were totally against Australia joining the IMF and the World Bank. The deadline for original membership of the IMF and World Bank was the end of 1945. We didn't join until 1947, towards the end of 1947. We were not an original member of the IMF and World Bank because Chifley knew that he didn't have the numbers, that the party would reject membership. And so he bided his time until he knew he had the numbers, which he had by 1947. But Eddie Ward and other members of the left wing of the party never forgave Chifley for that. Chifley made it quite clear that Australia should join, that these institutions were about enhancing the prosperity of the world economy, and Australia could not not join the institutions. Fadden, of course, brought... Okay, Fadden brought down the horror budget. Inflation was running at 25%. The horror budget lost a lot of support for the coalition government, but it brought inflation down to modest levels. Bill McMahon refused to devalue against sterling, with sterling in 1967. The Country Party, McEwen in particular, was totally against McMahon's decision not to devalue with sterling. A couple of weeks after the decision was made, Holt went missing at Cheviot Beach, and McMahon was the deputy leader of the Liberal Party and expected to become Holt's successor, and McEwen said the Country Party is not going to support a government led by McMahon. And I could go on, we haven't got time, but the point I'm making is that some of these people made some pretty courageous decisions and in some cases lost their seats, lost, in McMahon's case, the possibility of becoming Prime Minister 2 or 3 years before he actually became Prime Minister. So, Chris, comments?
Okay. Before we get Chris up, just to respond to that, then I think what we'll do is we'll go back to the audience, take questions, because we've only got to the top of the hour. Well, hang on. Just before you do, you just don't fall off, just step to there.
No, I've done that once before. No,
fallen off. Just be careful. I just want to say, we'll go straight to questions, but Janet Rundy's got some copies of The Money Man. I'm sure Chris Bowen would be happy to sign some, and Selwyn might add his own signature. It's a very well-regarded name in Australian economics. So do you want to respond briefly to what Selwyn said?
No.
No, OK. So let's go to questions and discussion. Down the back, we have a microphone, Anne, I think. OK, just before you do, who was your favourite? Not the person you agreed with most. Who was your favourite one writing? Apart from the older ones, the earlier ones you mentioned, I mean, what did you find was the most fun writing?
Well, apart from what Theodore and Page in the earlier ones, and, you know, I did enjoy writing Keating, and who I regard as objectively the best treasurer in Australian history, and then I have a list of treasurers to whom I describe honourable mentions who are in the top rank.
Has Keating read your chapter?
He has. And he provided favourable feedback on my conclusion.
Okay, it's good down the back there. Yeah. You got a microphone? Yeah, okay. Yes.
Mr. Bowen, one of the issues that all political parties one of the problems that all political parties face, and you guys will discern as well, is the issue of to what extent you come clean with the Aussie public about what you're going to do if and when you get elected. At one extreme, you had John Hewson, who was remarkably candid, so I'm going to raise taxes and I'm going to have a horror budget and da-da-da. At the other was Tony Abbott, who said we're going to cut taxes, not cut any spending, and we're going to cut the deficit in our first term.
Okay.
Which extreme are you going to go? So where do you fit in that, and has this book influenced that?
Well, I don't want to be overly political tonight, but I am at the end of the spectrum, which is you win a mandate. You win a mandate by seeking a mandate and being honest with people about what plans are. And of course, events will determine how you govern, and you'll have to respond to events, but you've got to have a framework and a mandate for which you've won and sought the confidence of the people. If you're going to be a successful government, yes, it's risky, but you need the moral authority to say we won a mandate to do these things. And I think there's been, and again, I don't want to be political tonight, but there's been instances where that hasn't occurred. In the historical context, I think the interesting point is that there was a modus operandi, of course, that a new Prime Minister and a new Treasurer always get a briefing from the Secretary of the Treasury the day after the election on the state of the books. And the modus operandi is the Treasurer holds a press conference and says, the books are so much worse than we thought and all our promises we can't afford and we're just going to have to start again because the other guys have just left a cupboard bare. Of course, Costello did it to Keating and to Beazley. Keating did it to Howard in 1983. Earl Page did it in the 1920s, exactly that playbook. Those days are gone. You can't do that anymore because there is a charter of budget honesty, to Peter Costello's credit, where the books were all open and transparent, so you can't use that excuse anymore, or you shouldn't, because it doesn't have any currency. And the Australian people, although they don't know the full intricacies and haven't studied the charter of budget honesty, they basically understand that point. But you must, in my view, win a mandate. You must be as forthright as you can be about your views, and that will lose you votes from time to time, but it gives you much greater moral authority to implement your agenda when in office.
So,
Keynes said that when he was asked why he changed his mind all the time, he said, when the facts change, so does my advice. I mean, you know, economic circumstances change and they can change very quickly.
Right, so who I can't see very
there's
well.
There's one over there.
Yes, there's a question there, yeah? And then up here. Yeah.
Question to Professor Cornyn.
Thank you.
Why did the Labor Party object to joining the World Bank and the IMF?
Good question. This was the international money power in operation. The Labor Party had been founded on the idea, in part anyway, that the money power had to be controlled, and the argument by Eddie Ward and his supporters was that these institutions were being advanced by international financiers who didn't have Labor, who didn't care very much about the working conditions and labour principles, labour objectives.
Okay, so a question here. Yes.
Question to Chris Bowman. Post 2008, the world's faced very different monetary circumstances. Great new policies have been done across the world, and I'd like to get more views, having a book about Australian treasurers, including yourself, grappling with what it's like to deal with those circumstances, and particularly interested from an Australian perspective and on monetary policy.
Yeah, thanks. It's a fantastic question. Yes, the world's changed since 2008, but there are still lessons from history. And I found Ted Theodore's story extremely instructive, the Treasurer during the Great Depression. He, of course, the subtitle for that chapter is A Treasurer Interrupted, because he had to deal with a scandal halfway through and withdraw from the Treasury while the nation was going through this great economic cataclysm. But interestingly, he introduced into Parliament the Fiduciary Notes Bill. If you look at what the Fiduciary Notes Bill did, it was quantitative easing. He wanted to print money, basically. He'd worked out, based on advice and Keynes's work, that there was a monetary shortage. And he said, well, what we need is a Fiduciary Notes Bill. And, of course, this was not long after Weimar Germany. This was seen as heresy. And the Conservatives, you know, said it was a scandal. And as he introduced the Fiduciary Notes Bill, the public gallery of the House of Representatives chamber, the old chamber, was packed.
and somebody got fake money, monopoly money, its equivalent, and threw it down in the chamber and said, this is what's going to happen, you're ruining our economy. And as I said, he was simply embracing quantitative easing. He was 80 years ahead of his time. And he couldn't pass the bill through the Senate. The Conservatives had the majority in the Senate. And if it succeeded, it wouldn't have solved the Great Depression in Australia. It would have ameliorated it. So there are lessons there. Yes, the world's moving faster. It's much more unstable than it was during the Great Moderation post-war. But we've dealt with the same or worse before.
So there's a question down here.
Thanks. We've heard so much commentary these days about the death of reform, and it's just impossible. Is the lesson that there's a recipe for reform that some of these treasurers have discovered, or are we at a particular point in time where the media and all these other factors are preventing such reform occurring?
No, I don't think so. I think that reform is always hard, and saying the 24-hour media cycle or the social media, rise of social media, prevents reform is a cop-out. I think the essential elements of reform are, where possible, seek a mandate. It's not always possible because you've got to respond to events like the float of the dollar in 1983, which was caused by a currency crisis, even though Hawke and Keating intuitively understood it was the right thing to do regardless. The currency crisis is what brought it about. Where you can seek a mandate and seek that moral authority. Two, explain, and advocate. And that's what some of the great treasurers have done, Keating, Costello on the GST, all the others who had reform agendas. A consistent message, not a chopping, changing message, a consistent message about why change is necessary and explaining it. And the support of your Prime Minister, absolutely essential. If you look at the successful Prime Ministers and Treasurers, combinations, Bruce and Page, Curtin and Keating, Curtin and Chifley, Hawke and Keating, Howard and Costello, despite their differences and in many cases their conflicting ambitions for the Prime Ministership, working effectively as a team and using their complementary skills to communicate. I mean, Bob Hawke at his prime, one of the best communicator in the nation, and Keating with his unique command of the English language in his own style and putting that into battle for economic reform, an amazing combination, and their different communication styles. Hawke with his empathy and Keating with his passion coming through, and to a different degree, Howard and Costello, both good communicators in their different ways. And being out there, as John Howard said to me in the book, Treasurer's got to be in the media every day selling the case. And, of course, the Treasurer's key job is to be the one pushing the envelope for change and reform within the government. I argue in the book, the Treasurer doesn't need to win every battle within the government. Keating didn't win every one. Costello didn't win every battle. But they need to win most. Otherwise, they're untenable in the role.
So, questions
from the right at the back.
Okay. There's one over here. Yeah.
Question for Chris. We've had the tradition of strong-willed Treasury secretaries. What is the your lessons, or are there any lessons from your 12 treasurers and their interactions with their respective Treasury secretaries?
Yeah, Solomon might want to answer this as well because he's an expert in the Treasury secretaries. I think the key lesson for me is the relationship between the Treasurer primarily and the Secretary and the Treasury more generally has to be strong. By that I mean mutual trust. There are some instances where trust is broken down, Cairns and the Treasury elect against Cairns. There's no historical question about that. They were leaking against their Treasurer. They felt justified in doing so. They were leaking against their Minister, their Treasurer, and there's some evidence that the trust towards the end had broken down between Howard as Treasurer and the Treasury, and that there was some leaking going on, perhaps. Well, there was leaking going on because Laurie Oakes announced the budget. He had the entire budget delivered to him before Howard had delivered it. In the most notable Treasury leak in, spectacular leak in history. But the Treasurer has to trust the Treasury. It doesn't mean he has to agree with them all the time. You've got to take their ideas and hold them to the light and push them around and test yourself that you're satisfied. You've also got to push them, say, I want to do this, I want to do that. What's your advice on the best way of getting there? Relationship has to be good with the Secretary and with the entire Treasury. Again, another I find compelling story in here is the story of the float, Keating wanting to float, and John Stone saying, no, you can't float, and Keating feeling early in his tenure, hard to imagine now, but so early in his tenure, not feeling confident enough to overrule the secretary. And he had the governor on board, which Howard, in fairness, did not have. Howard couldn't convince the governor or the secretary to float, whereas Keating and Johnston had agreed to float, and Stone was still against it. There was a meeting in Keating's Parliament House office with the senior Treasury executives, and normally the advice to a Treasury is monolithic. They agree on the advice and that's it. They all speak with one voice. And Keating, frustrated, says to them, "Doesn't anybody agree with me on the float? Don't any of you economists agree with me?" And Ted Evans, the quietly spoken, softly spoken former electrical engineer, but very fine economist and great contributor to Australia's economic success, says, in Stone's presence, timidly, "I support you, Treasurer." And that was enough for Keating, and he said to Stone, "You will never roll me again after today." So it was a robust relationship. But you've got to take Treasury's ideas and then win the arguments in Cabinet if you're convinced of them, and you give them your own ideas and make the case. I don't know if Selwyn's got any other thoughts.
No, I agree. I think it's a good question. And in fact, it was a question I was going to ask Chris myself, because it's not only been in recent times, but if you look back in the 20s and 30s, there were powerful Treasury secretaries, but particularly during the 50s and 60s, Sir Roland Wilson, the longest-serving Treasury secretary, had a terrific relationship with Fadden and Holt. In fact, the relationship between Holt and Wilson went back to 1940, when the Department of Labor and National Service was created, and Holt was the first minister, and Holt wanted Wilson to be the first head. I think, for the most part anyway, treasurers and treasury secretaries have worked well together. There have only been a few instances where they didn't work well. But the governor of the Central Bank, the governor of the Reserve Bank, and before that the governor of the Commonwealth Bank were critically important too. And Chifley picked Coombs to be governor of the Commonwealth Bank, which was then the Central Bank, and they had a very good relationship. And just on the float issue, as Chris said, the Treasury head was against floating. The governor of the Reserve Bank, Bob Johnston, was very much for floating. If both of them had been against, then there wouldn't have been a float. Simple as that. Johnston, the governor, had a very good relationship. Keating and Johnston had a very good relationship. So.
You want to make another comment, Chris?
No.
Okay. So there's a question down there. Yes.
Thank you for your comments so far. I've just been piqued my interest actually in Australian Treasurers. Chris, I'm interested in how the process has changed or influenced you and your views, and then so on over the numerous cups of tea, how you've seen Chris's views and ideas change, if they have. Thank you.
It's a question about how you've seen events change.
And as if I interpret the question correctly, in the course of writing the book, perhaps, and what I've learned. Well, I didn't set out to write the book with any particular theme in mind. I started out wanting to write the book, and then the theme sort of sprung out at me as I wrote it. The themes are good relationship with the Prime Minister, and there are, as I said, spectacular examples in here about how they fall apart. There's also Prime Ministers and Treasurers who've had great personal tension, but nevertheless formed a very effective working relationship, and that is key. If a Treasurer is pushing forward, but the Prime Minister is not in favour of it, the Treasurer is going to be regarded as a failure, as John Howard was. John Howard, basically, his instincts were right, but he could never convince the Cabinet or the Prime Minister of the necessary reforms. So he's regarded in history, and he is quite sanguine and fair about his own legacy as Treasurer, as not a success. Whereas Keating and Hawke, despite their tensions, were on board with the exception of the famous 1985 tax summit and telecommunications reform. They were largely on the same page for reform. Relationship between the Treasurer and the Treasury, I suppose that makes intuitive sense, but that's very key going forward, and again, some examples. So I think that the sort of two things, particularly the PM-Treasurer relationship, which I guess you sort of expect, but only in writing the book was it really brought home to me just historically how important that is.
The question was, did we change our views as a result of writing the book for Chris and reading the book from my point of view? Was that?
Yeah, Chris, did you see?
Did you see Chris's viewpoints change during the period of writing it? In other words, did you have any influence on him, I guess?
Well, that's for Chris. One important thing, which I was very pleased to see in the book, the Reserve Bank has said for quite some time that inflation targeting, you know, which is the monetary framework that they've been using now since the early 90s, commenced in 1993. And, you know, publication after publication, inflation targeting in Australia started in 93. And I said to them, why 93? And they said, well, Bernie Fraser, the governor, made a speech in 93 saying that it would be good if we could keep inflation between 2 and 3%. And I said, but he made a speech in 92 saying exactly the same thing. So why 93 rather than 92? And I think, Chris, in an early draft, you had 93, and I'd convinced the governor that it was 92, 93. And I was pleased to see that, although a student, a PhD student, that I've been helping at ANU, writing on monetary policy, he gave a seminar and he said 93, and I said, no, it's 92. He said, well, the Reserve Bank better change its what it says on its website. And I went there, and there's a graph with an arrow saying 93, you know, that's when it started. So I immediately phoned up the bank and said, please change that graph, and they changed it within half an hour. So that's just one example. But
so it's 92, right?
Right. So it's 92, but...
Right, we got it. At the Sydney Institute.
Yes. That's right.
Okay. Over here. Yeah.
Thanks for your speech. Eddie's book on capitalism has shown the deleterious effect that inequality has on economic growth and the economy generally. How will that learning inform your policies you're developing at the moment?
Did you say Piketty's book?
Yeah.
Oh, it's
might just background Piketty's book.
Piketty's book on basically arguing that a rise in inequality is almost inevitable without active government intervention. It's an important contribution. I don't agree with everything in it, of course, but it's a very, very serious work. It should be read by policymakers, and there are some other serious works as well out, including the most recent Inequality, What is to be Done, which is more practical, if you like. Look, what I think Piketty's book has done, I hope, has been an important contribution to the dispelling the myth that inequality is good for growth. Inequality is not good for growth. Inequality is bad for growth. Greater equality is actually supportive of greater economic growth. And that is perhaps a divide in politics around the world and in economics. Those of us who believe that A, fighting inequality is a good thing from a social justice point of view, but also is a good thing from an economic point of view, as opposed to those who say, well, more inequality means more growth and we'll go for growth. I don't accept that argument.
So, when do you want to make a comment on Piketty?
No, I haven't read Piketty.
Done with that stuff.
But yeah. I have another.
Hang on.
I'd like
okay.
to make another point.
Okay, well, hang on. You make your point, but come up to the microphone. Make your point.
Well, I think one of the. Sorry.
No. You make your point.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Into the microphone.
One of the interesting things that Chris brings out in his book is that there have been 38 treasurers. Eight of them have formal university qualifications in economics, including Chris himself. But several of the very prominent treasurers, your Theodores and your Chipleys and your Keatings and so on, you know, as I said earlier, left school at a very, very early age. And I think you make the point, I'm just trying to pick it up here, you say that that knowledge counts, not qualifications. And Edmund Dell, in his History of British Chancellors, makes a similar point. He says, economic management is an art and not a science. And this point is important, is of some significance to me, because I've spent 60 years teaching economics and economic history at ANU, and yet if you look at the backgrounds of the treasurers, that having an economics degree doesn't seem to be all that important.
Okay, there's a question there.
Okay. I just have a question, Cornish. Would there be a public benefit in a book on governors of the Reserve Bank, and would that be as interesting?
So come up here. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Well, there will be a section in the book I'm writing. I'm writing a book on the Reserve Bank from 1970 to 2000, and there will be a section on governors there. But perhaps there deserves to be a book itself on governors, and there've been some interesting appointments over the years.
So I think it might be the second last question down there, Milton. Are there two? Okay, right, one there, one there.
Yes. I guess one of the bigger sort of events in Australia was that when we tried to nationalise the banks and none of the book came, I'm not sure if it's in the book. But I was just going to ask, what was the sort of, it's not possible with Professor Cornish, but also Christian has stabbed at it, but what was the sort of learning or the logic behind doing it?
There's a question about the Shipley's decision to nationalise the banks in 1947 when he was Prime Minister.
And Treasurer at the same time.
Yeah.
Sue will no doubt add. It was a disastrous mistake, of course. But what led chiefly to this conclusion was his innate distrust of the banks, having served on the Royal Commission and lived through the Depression and seen the Commonwealth Bank, the then central bank, play an appalling role, frankly, during the Great Depression, and the private banks play a role not much better. He was deeply distrustful. And he had been convinced, it's fair to say, I think, primarily by Nugget Coombs, but by others as well, that tighter regulation of the banks would be enough. All they need to do is get some proper prudential regulation and some tighter regulation, you wouldn't need to nationalise them. And then, of course, the banks proceeded to challenge that in the High Court and the Privy Council, and won. And they started chipping away at the regulation. And Chifley worked out, probably correctly, that they'd just keep going until the regulations were worn down and not effective. Now, instead of dealing with that, Chifley's answer was to nationalise. And it was a disastrous error, of course, and cost him government inevitably, including cost him his seat on the Abercrombie Shire Council, which he lost in the local government elections of 1948, I think. As Prime Minister, he lost election to his local council, having served on it for many years, well, because bank nationalisation was so unpopular. And, of course, they didn't sell it at all. It was bad policy, but the Cabinet made the decision unanimously to nationalise the banks and then issued a one-line press release which said the Cabinet met tonight and decided to nationalise the banks, full stop. And that was it. No explaining to the Australian people, and of course it ended inevitably on the way it did. But at its core, it was mistrust of the banks and fear about what was going to happen as they... The regulation was sound regulation, justified regulation, appropriate regulation, but the banks didn't like it, and they decided to take it on in the court and end up with nationalisation.
Selwyn.
No, that's a good question. There was a book written some time ago on the bank nationalisation issue. At the Royal Commission in 1936-37, Chifley wrote a minority report in which he advocated the nationalisation of the banks. So his position was fairly clear. But in 1944, when the government was thinking about what it should do so far as the banking system is concerned in the post-war era, Coombs, who was head of the Department of Post-War Reconstruction, and Chifley was the Minister for Post-War Reconstruction, Coombs said to him, look, we can control the banks, we don't have to nationalise them. And so Chifley went ahead with, in 1945, changing the Commonwealth Bank Act to give the Commonwealth Bank greater control of the banks, short of nationalising them. And then the private banks started to chip away, as Chris said, at key elements of the 1945 Commonwealth Bank Act and the 1945 Banking Act. And Chifley thought that the only way really to control the private banks was to nationalise them in those circumstances. So.
Milton.
Chris, going back to the floating of the dollar, if you speak to Bob Hawke and Bob Hawke's advisers at the time, the Manchu Court, as Paul used to call them, they will tell you that they had to drag him screaming and kicking to the floats. Do you have a judgment as to which version of history is correct?
Yeah, I do. It is one of the great historical contests between a Prime Minister and a Treasurer, and I make the point in the book that sometimes the relationship between a Prime Minister and Treasurer falls down while they're in office, and sometimes just as regularly it falls down later over the fights over the legacy of who's responsible for the successes and responsible for the failures. And look, it's true that they both wanted to float the dollar. John Edwards is here, he's written about this in his very fine book on the Keating period, and I think I'm right in saying I reached the same conclusion as John. They both wanted to float the dollar. It wasn't an argument between them. It might have been some nuancing about who was more virulent about it and who got there first. But there's no doubt that Keating wanted to float the dollar, in my mind. As I said, he'd been contemplating it for months, and if he could have convinced Stone earlier, he would have done it earlier. But he couldn't. He didn't feel he could overrule the Secretary of Treasury. And, of course, it was the currency crisis which brought the immediate decision to float. They had to float. Although, interestingly, John Howard said to me, even if he'd still been Treasurer in 1983, in December 1983 with the currency crisis, he could not have floated the dollar. He said, there is no way I could have convinced the Cabinet I was a member of to float the dollar or my Prime Minister. Even with a massive currency crisis, they would have just not done it. So I come down on the side that Keating did not need to be dragged kicking and screaming. He did want to do it. That's not to take away credit from Bob Hawke, who, if he didn't want to do it, it wouldn't have happened. It's to his credit that he agreed to it happening and he was in favour of it happening. But the sort of thesis that Keating was somehow not wanting to do it is I can't find support for.
Just a final question to the author. Could I just say that I
agree exactly with Chris's interpretation. Both Bob Hawke and Paul Keating both supported strongly and had for some time floating the dollar. It was just a matter of time. I think Keating wanted to try and get John Stone, the Treasury Secretary, on side, but it was clear that he wasn't going to support the float. But dragging Keating into the decision, kicking and screaming, is not correct.
Just a final question to the author. You have an economics degree, but your background was in the trade union movement, it was in local government politics, and you held a very senior position in the Rudd Labor government. So, as I recall, you told me you'd commenced this book when you were a minister. So what made you think about writing this, and is there anything else in the top drawer?
I've been thinking about this book for some time, and in many senses I'd been researching it just by my, reading for pleasure about economic history and the history of Australian politics. I didn't commence writing it until after the election, and I didn't sort of formalise it as a program. I mentioned in the acknowledgements that the way the book came about was Louise Adler, the chief executive of Melbourne University Press, rang me just after the election and said, how about some memoirs of your time in office? And I said, there's far too much of that going on already. And I'm far too young to be writing memoirs anyway. And I said, I'll tell you what, I've always wanted to write a history of Australian treasurers. And she said, her response, which I remember was, to this day, was, I'm there. I'll send you a contract. So that's how the book formally came about. Do I have another book in me? Well, hopefully not for a little while, because I intend to be otherwise engaged for the next at least 3 years as treasurer. Yeah.
So first of all, thanks to Lendlease for the use of this farm facility this evening. It's worked very well and we're grateful. To Chris Bowen for an important book. And as you know tonight, the breadth of Mr. Bowen's knowledge across a whole range of not only economic matters but also economic history and historical matters and politics is very impressive. And this book, as you know, goes all the way back to Federation and finishes within the last couple of years, so that's a very important contribution. To Selwyn Cornish, who is, of course, one of Australia's leading economists, who's made some very important contributions tonight. Now, there are copies of The Money Men available with Janet Grundy, but I just should say thank you to Selwyn for an important contribution and to the author for a great job. Thank you very much. Okay.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.